2016 is passing into history. The new year is just around the corner, and it's time for a year-end review. Today we play excerpts from some of our top 10 of 2016. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, on PRX, and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. First up, we spoke back in February with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer about her acclaimed book about the Koch brothers and the network they've mobilized for political influence. The book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Given that that radical right is now poised to assume control over our government, I thought it would be a good place to begin today's show. I started out by asking Jane Mayer about the scope of the Koch brothers' fortune and their reach into the economic life of our nation.
Well, it's funny because Koch Industries used to call itself the biggest company that nobody's ever heard of. It's a pretty secretive company because it's privately owned by these two brothers with a couple other shares left over for one or two other people. But they basically own the whole thing. It does $115 billion worth of business a year. And even though most Americans aren't familiar with it as a name, they're very familiar with its products. So it makes Lycra, it makes Stainmaster carpet, it makes Dixie cups, Georgia Pacific lumber, and it has a huge profile in the fossil fuel world. It refines a quarter of the oil from Canada that comes into America is refined by just one of the refineries that the Kochs own.
And I believe their fossil fuel holdings they're in the top 10, is that right?
They are among the largest polluters in America also, partly because of the fossil fuel businesses they do. But they are among the top ranks of polluters in all three categories of pollution, according to a recent study done by the University of Massachusetts in Amherst: air pollution, water pollution, and climate pollution. And they've also been, quite recently, according to EPA statistics, the largest toxic waste producer in America. So they have a very checkered past in terms of their record on environmental issues. They've been prosecuted a number of times for violations of the laws having to do with pollution.
Now let's talk a little bit about the Koch network, because this book is not just about them. Early on in the book, you talk about a meeting by the Koch brothers, a summit that they called in June of 2010. Talk about some of the people who were there.
Well, this is a good point. And so people tend to sort of think that the Koch brothers are sort of the locus of political activism on the far right in big money circles in America. But the reason they're so important is not just that they're so fabulously rich and put so much money into this cause, but they've gathered around them a group of 400 or 500 other extraordinarily wealthy conservatives, which increases their throw weight tremendously. It's kind of like a magic trick. They've gotten all these other fortunate conservatives to put their money into a kind of a kitty and pool it so that they can have joint political ventures together. And who's in the group? It's a combination of a number of major fossil fuel figures. The largest private owner of coal in America is a member. His name is Corbin Benson Jr. There are frackers, from the people who use hydraulic fracturing to try to get gas from shale and oil from shale. And there are a number of major financiers. Steve Schwartzman has been a member of this group, and Stephen Cohen from SAC Capital. These are hugely wealthy hedge fund managers and investors. And some long-time and often privately held family companies like the Bechtel Company, the members of that family have been part of this group too, as has the DeVos family, which were the founders of Amway. So those are a few of the fortunes that are involved in this. And each one has its own kind of dynastic story. But when they put their fortunes together, it really creates a tremendous war chest for the political activities of this group.
Yeah, and you mentioned Stephen Schwarzman, the CEO of the Blackstone Group, that's the biggest real estate investment firm in the world. Just recently during the campaign, in fact, I believe even this week, Hillary Clinton has met with the Blackstone Group a number of times. They're major donors to her foundation and campaign. I wonder if you could talk about the bipartisan nature of the establishment that receives money from these billionaires.
Well, the Kochs themselves really are not bipartisan. They are, if anything, to the right of the Republican Party. So occasionally they'll give money to a Democrat, but usually it's a Democratic representative from some area where they have some business and they see it as sort of an expedient reason to back somebody's campaign. But both parties have big money, and both parties are reliant because of campaign financing on super powerful private interests. And as we've seen over the years, Wall Street's been a source of a lot of the funding for the Democratic Party, while it's also been a huge source for Republican Party financing, and as have many other big businesses. But, you know, this is, unfortunately, the nature of politics today, given that people need so much money to run for office.
Yeah, Citizens United being one of those reasons why. Now, about this group, though, still on them, you write that it was striking how many members of the Koch network have had serious past or ongoing legal problems. I wonder if you could give us some examples, not quite yet of the Kochs, because we'll reserve a special place for them.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is that the philosophy of most of the members of the Koch network, and they describe it themselves as a network, and they describe the secret members as investors, but the philosophy of many of these people is that they argue that it's better for America to get the government out of the way of business. But when you look at it closely, what you find is many of them have businesses that have tangled with the government, specifically with the legal system. And they have sort of very self-interested reasons. It's not really pure philosophy for getting the government off the backs of business. An awful lot of them had tax problems and other issues. Take Sheldon Adelson, for instance, who is a casino owner from Las Vegas. I mean, he was under investigation by the Justice Department for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is basically suggesting that there were allegations that his company had bribed foreign officials to get business. And issues like that were rife among this group. So there were a lot of, if you go down the line, there were an awful lot with tangled legal problems.
Yeah, I think Stephen Cohen of SAC Capital Advisors was accused of insider trading, although...
Well, the government never made the case against Cohen specifically, not a criminal case, but something like 7 people who worked for him in his firm were accused of insider trading or other kind of violations of securities laws. And his firm was described as having all kinds of problems along that front. These people were poster childs for corporate malfeasance, a lot of them. So and I think that's something, it's a reason why the public really needs to know who's involved in this group.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jane Mayer about her latest book. It's called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And the Kochs, of course, because they are, because their holdings are so great in the area of fossil fuels, they've really gone after environmental laws. There's been a real pattern of lawbreaking on their part, and even people have died. I wonder if you could give us some examples of things that they have done and how government regulation has tried to rein them in and how they fought against those regulations.
Well, there was a horrendous case that was brought against Koch Industries following a pipeline disaster. One of their pipelines blew up in Texas, and it killed two teenagers who were driving nearby. And the families of the teenagers brought a wrongful death suit against the company and won. And the judgment was, at the time, the biggest one ever on record. Because during the court case, what came out was that some of the people who worked for the company said that the company was, to some extent, aware that this situation was dangerous and hadn't done enough to correct it. So the judgment took that into account, and it was just humongous. It was a horrible case. Two kids died. There are a number of sort of workplace safety cases that have been brought against Coke Industries. I tell the story of the widow of one man who worked for the company for many years who died of leukemia that the widow said he'd gotten from being exposed to benzene, which is a carcinogen, at the workplace at Coke Industries. And the company kept fighting the widow, but finally made a deal with her and basically paid her off. You know, it's a hardball-playing company. And it has a history of pushing the envelope on legal matters, and particularly on environmental matters.
Part of playing hardball is also intimidation of people who try to either get redress in the courts or to expose what they're doing.
That is true. One of the things, it took a number of years to research this, but as I was, I came across many cases of people who, when tried to challenge Coke Industries in one way or another, had felt themselves somewhat intimidated by people working for the company. Either they were whistleblowers, or in one story I tell, there's a former FBI agent who is investigating Coke Industries on behalf of the Senate, the U.S. Senate, which was doing an investigation of whether Coke had stolen oil from Indian reservations. And this FBI agent, who's named Jim Elroy, describes how he discovered while he was doing this federal investigation, he was tailed by someone. He'd never had this happen to him before as an FBI agent. And in fact, he tells the story, he stopped the person who was tailing him at gunpoint, pulled him out of the car, and the person said that he was working for the Kochs. So there are actually a number of private eyes who pop up along the way. The brothers, for instance, had something like 20 years of litigation against each other. They're four brothers, and they broke into two teams of two, and the two teams of brothers hired private eyes to spy on each other, going through each other's garbage. So, again, the tactics that are used by this group are very, very rough, which is why I think their influence in American politics is something that Americans deserve to, you know, be fully aware of.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about the secrecy as well.
Well, the company has this long history of being quite secret. Charles Koch's motto for many years, which he said he took from his father, was, it's when the whale spouts that it gets harpooned. So rather than getting harpooned, he would prefer to swim underwater and not be public about his activities. And so the company has kept its own activities quite quiet. It's a private company with no shareholders other than the brothers, really, and a couple others. And when they meet with the donor group, which they've gathered around them since about 2003 or 2004, they don't put out the names, and they won't release the names or even confirm the names of who their investors are in this political project that they've undertaken. They've sometimes gone to such lengths to kind of protect the secrecy that at one gathering they even posted sort of white noise-emitting machines on the perimeters in order to kind of make a crackling static sound that would keep the public and the press from being able to eavesdrop in any way on what was taking place inside the resort where the investors were meeting.
Jane Mayer, talking about her book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Next, I spoke with Laurette Savoy about her book, Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Looked at from a cultural perspective, Laurette Savoy could be the quintessential American. Her ancestry mixes African-American, Euro-American, and Native American heritages, an inheritance shrouded in silence for much of her childhood. Her path to trace that heritage is recounted in her beautiful new book, Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Savoy is a digger into the depths. She's an earth scientist and cultural historian who reads the palimpsest of time in the geological record, deciphering the traces of history, human and wild. She's also an eloquent storyteller whose lyrical language evokes the meanings contained in landscape, meanings that speak above all of the relationships between us and all that surrounds us. As professor of environmental studies at Mount Holyoke College, Laurette Savoy is acutely attuned to the relationship between us and the land, a relationship that must be founded on a moral bedrock if we're to survive. But she also traces the connections between us and those who have gone before us, not just in history, but in her own personal story. Well, Laurette Savoy, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Trace, was so beautiful and powerful and moving, a real delight to read. I'd like to start out by asking you to describe to us what that word trace means to you in the vision of this book.
I wanted to find a title that was simple and direct, and that was a word that wasn't a hard word, in that it didn't end with a hard sound, an abrupt sound. I wanted something that trace, that left room for thinking, for pondering, as if the word itself hadn't ended. And in this case, I wanted a title that could be taken as a verb and a noun, the action as well as the action being described. And so in this case, it indicates in the book the very active search that I undertake, the paths of the journeys that I took, but also the tracks and vestiges of what once was. And if I could just say most simply, the book really is a search for how the unvoiced past marks a person, in this case me, but also marks a people and marks the American land. And in this case, the traces were about finding home in this country. And that is trying to place myself or place oneself not only in the land, but in time, across generations and in history. So trace, the search, the paths I took, as well as the pieces of the past that I tried to find.
Laurette Savoy talking about her book, Trace. And because the beauty of her language is as powerful as the depth of her ideas, let's listen to a brief excerpt from the prologue to Trace, read by the author herself for Writer's Voice.
Prologue, Thoughts on a Frozen Pond. In the dead of winter, I like to walk on water, held above liquid depths of the nearby lake by a vast frozen plain. This ice demands respect. I look again, I listen again, attentive to any crack or yielding to my weight. When the surface is more solid than a hardwood dance floor and much thicker, I venture far. Even then, I hear the gloop, a distant blurp, a muffled gloosh, water undulating beneath ice and me. Sunlight appears to emanate from above and below on cloudless February days, raying through the crystalline lattice underfoot. With my eyes but inches from the surface, any sense of depth, of refracted distance, yields to a sense of motion arrested. Air bubbles halt in mid-ascent. White oak leaves descend as if on invisible steps, suspended for a season above the lake bottom. The recent past lies beneath me in these leaves, plucked and blown here by January's heavy winds. Inches away, they are out of reach. I kneel within the next stratum. Thoughts of time's passage always come to mind on such walks, thoughts of how memory of any form becomes inscribed in the land. The hills surrounding this lake and my home are worn remains of long vanished mountains. Glacial debris from the last ice age produces a rock crop in my garden each spring. stone walls that 2 centuries ago bordered fields and pastures now thread the dark heart of forests.
Laurette Savoy reading from the prologue to her book, Trace. Thinking about the natural environment leads me inevitably to the terrible harm being done to it by, for example, fracking. Jennifer Haig's terrific novel, Heat and Light, explores what happens to a poor rural region in the Pennsylvania Rust Belt when the frackers come to town and rip apart the social fabric of the community. I started out by asking Jennifer Haig what drew her to the story.
Well, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and a lot of my family still lives there. So this gas drilling question was on my radar from the very beginning. When I started writing Heat and Light, the gas drilling boom was going full force, and there was a pretty vibrant national debate about whether this was a good idea. If you remember, Josh Fox's documentary Gasland had just come out. There was a very heated campaign in New York State to uphold the governor's moratorium on fracking. So it was a politically charged issue at that time. Since then, there have been some developments. Some things have changed. Most significantly, the gas and oil market has tanked. So drilling right now is in a holding pattern. But it's not over. It's a sort of a temporary lull. So this is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, so one of the themes of this book is the transformations that happen to people when something like this happens. I mean, long-time, friendships change. Certainly marriages change. Relationships change. I just wonder if you could say a little bit about your thought process in connecting this profound social change in the community with the personal changes that the characters go through.
Sure. I think it's a truism, but there's a lot of truth in it, that money does change the way people interact with each other. And it's particularly true in this town where nobody's ever had money before, and nobody's ever thought of themselves as a prosperous person. And so it completely shatters all their ways of being and all their ways of seeing themselves.
Talk a little bit about the company that comes in, Dark Elephant. I just love that name. And so this company comes in. Talk about the impact. What actually happens when, you know, here we have Rich Devlin. What happens to his great surprise when they actually start operations? What happens when you have somebody starting to frack on your land?
Well, the first thing that happens is a crew comes in to strip away the vegetation, to cut down any trees that might be there. The land needs to be level, so in terrain like western Pennsylvania that's very mountainous, you need a crew to come in and smooth it down, basically steamroll it. So the whole topography of his property changes almost overnight so that they can move this giant drill rig in. Another thing that happens a lot in western Pennsylvania, the roads are narrow and winding, and a lot of them are simply not wide enough to accommodate a drill rig, so a lot of new roads have to be built. So that's the first thing that happens. When the drilling itself starts, the main disturbance I hear about from people is the noise, and the noise is really epic. It's hard to convey how overpowering it is. So the noise is particularly problematic for Rich Devlin because he works at night. This is a prison guard who works the night shift, comes home, and needs to get some sleep. And he finds this virtually impossible once the drilling starts.
And also, there's light as well.
Right. They're like stadium lights, you know, that kind of light that there's no blocking it out. They work 24/7. This is a very expensive operation, so once it starts, it's not going to stop until it's complete. So it's relentless. It simply never stops.
Jennifer Haig, from our interview with her about her novel, Heat and Light. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're playing excerpts from some of our favorite interviews of 2016. You can hear the full interviews by going to this week's show page and following the links to our archives. We'll have more after the break. Don't go away.
There was a knock one morning. A man was standing at my door. He said, "Hello, I'm from Halliburton. Have you heard of us before? We'd like to lease your backyard to drill for natural gas. It's called hydraulic fracturing, and it is the very pass for a clean energy future above the Marcellus Stone. Plus, we'll give you lots of money and a new mobile phone." I said, "You are a corporate crook. I don't believe the things you tell, and you can drive right off my property and then go straight to hell. No fracking way. No fracking way. I don't trust corporate salesmen, whatever they may say. No fracking way. No fracking way. No fracking way." My neighbor was out of work, and things were looking grim. So when the fracking guy came knocking, he had better luck with him. The company said, "Don't worry, everything will just be fine. So just sign your name right here, sir, on this dotted line."
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, Donald Trump was elected president in 2016. We had a robust series on the election, and one interview was with political cartoonist Ted Rall about his graphic biography of Donald Trump. Back in August, when we aired that interview, I said in my introduction, quote, "If you believe current forecasts, Donald Trump isn't all that likely to become president of the United States in November." Guess we shouldn't have believed those forecasts. The media missed one of the biggest stories of the election, the Democratic Party elite's failure to address the concerns of the white working class, folks like those in Jennifer Haig's novel we heard about earlier. Ted Rall's book, Trump, A Graphic Biography, pointed presciently to the candidate's support among a working class that has long been in a world of hurt. Not all those voters were white, but many of them were.
We all are familiar with the hollowing out of the middle class caused by increasing income inequality in the post-Vietnam War era over the last 50 years. And we all know what's happened to the formerly industrial cities of the Midwest, now called the Rust Belt. And these places have been gutted. And so, you know, there's different political analyses within the mainstream two-party electoral process that take different takes on what exactly caused this rising unemployment, the outsourcing of jobs, and so on. And, of course, the rise of a super-rich class at the expense of the middle class and increasing poverty throughout the country. On the left, the interpretation has been to blame the rich. And so that's where I am. That's where my sympathies lie, and the ruling classes. And that analysis is fairly straightforward, and it basically boils down to look to the powers that be and the controlling interests. And, you know, people who are in charge are by definition in charge and therefore have the most control. And we look at the free trade agreements like NAFTA, WTO back in the 90s, and the GATT agreement and so on. And you can see some common threads between left and right, both progressives as well as members of the Tea Party on the right hate those agreements and hold them largely responsible for taking away American jobs and hurting the middle class. But where the right differs is that it taps more into the nativism and xenophobia that's always been part of American politics on the, not just on the right, but mostly on the right. And so it comes down to, well, you know, foreigners are stealing our jobs. Now, Donald Trump has played the politics of nativism and isolationism since at least the 1980s. This has clearly been his worldview all along. But by attaching himself to this very fringe political movement, this billionaire developer suddenly legitimized it. And that really excited the far right. The far right couldn't believe that this guy who has buildings named after him had legitimized them and their politics. And that's really how he jump-started his 2016 campaign.
Many in the political elite blamed the outcome of the election on white voters' support for Trump's racism and bigotry, even fascism. Ted Rall points to the birther movement and how Trump's use of it excited the radical right support for his campaign. In this excerpt at the end of our interview, I asked Rall whether he thought Trump was a fascist. So finally, let's get to the F word, fascism. Do you think Trump is a fascist?
No, I don't. And that's because it would be an insult to fascists. Fascism is a developed political philosophy. It has a coherent thread that Donald Trump doesn't have in his thinking. Donald Trump is more of an accidental authoritarian. That's the title of one of the chapters in my book. He's a guy who basically discovered by talking to crowds that certain lines get applause and certain lines don't. And he repeats the ones that get applause, and he stops repeating the ones that don't. That's his shtick. Now, when you're giving talks to right-wing audiences, the lines that get a lot of applause are those about throwing Mexicans out of the country, banning Muslims, cracking down on terrorism, and so on. And that's been the basis of his entire candidacy this cycle and his nomination. His authoritarian impulse is undeniable. His great interest in law and order, talks about it, thinks about it, cares about it, his obsession with first responders, the military, and how people must follow the rules. He is not about freedom. He is about control by the state. But he blundered into this ideology. It's not something that he thought about. He didn't read up on Marshal Pétain. He doesn't know who Tito was. He certainly didn't study the works of Hitler and Mussolini, although there are reports that he supposedly had a book of Hitler speeches by his bed. I think Ivana said that, but that may not have been true. And he says that he never read them, and I believe him. There's no indication that he reads books at all.
Mm-hmm. And yet, the machinery of authoritarianism has already been put in place long before Trump, should he become president, would be able to use it. And that machinery has been put into place basically since 2001.
That's right. I mean, you know, people forget that Bush is gone, but that Bush's works remain. And, for example, we never got habeas corpus back. The Military Commissions Act remains in force. The U.S. president, including President Obama, continue to assert the right to assassinate any American citizen, including with a drone, including on U.S. territory. That is a legal right of the president that they assert. I mean, it's not legal according to the Constitution, but the Constitution gets ignored a lot, as people in Guantanamo can attest.
Ted Rall, talking about his book, Trump, A Graphic Biography. The suspicions that the Republican Party rigged swing state elections for Donald Trump have been growing, although you'd be hard-put to find them in the mainstream media. One method was massive voter suppression. We spoke both to Greg Palast and Ari Berman about those in two other episodes among our top 10. You'll find links to those interviews on our website. But we also talked with longtime election integrity activist Jonathan Simon about the shocking vulnerability of our electronic voting machines and the evidence that that vulnerability is being exploited to flip elections. His book is Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. Now, you wrote the book Code Red, which is, well, first tell us about the title. What does Code Red refer to?
Well, Code Red, you know, it sounds like some sort of emergency, and that's what this is. But apart from that, there's code inside voting machines, voting computers, and our analysis, all our data gathering and analysis over the past 15 years indicates that a lot of that code is vulnerable to manipulation, both by insiders and hackers. And the direction of that manipulation has been almost always, it's unilateral, and it's what we call a red shift, because the Republican or more right-wing candidates do better in the vote counts than they do in exit polls, they do in any other measure. So we suspect that inside of the machines, the manipulation that's going on is intentional. It's not just glitches. And it's taking, if you want to call it blue code or regular white code, and turning it red, just, you know, it's a metaphor mm-hmm. for the fact that these elections are being manipulated and really leading to a coup, basically a rolling right-wing coup in America, which I think people are finally beginning to take notice of. not only that it's a right-wing coup, but even people on the right, there's the feeling of an abridgment of public sovereignty, that people are not being represented, that the government is not governing with the consent of the governed. And we think a big, big part of that, from all the forensic evidence that we've gathered, has to do with the actual, very simple, direct manipulation or rigging of American elections inside the computers.
Inside the computers, is that the only way that elections are rigged?
It depends on how you use the term rigged. There are a lot of strategies and schemes that have always been used to alter or influence the outcome of elections. I mean, for many years, it was very retail. It was ballot box stuffing, ballots being thrown out. So there have always been methods, and that's because elections are very, very high-stakes games. They are for all the marbles. I mean, you control the government and the direction of a state or of a country. There's a lot in that for people, both in terms of financial reward and in terms of power and influence. So they're very vulnerable targets. But what's happened with the introduction and the proliferation of computerized vote counting is it's become possible and actually quite easy to do it wholesale, to target elections, to change the results of not just one election, but dozens, hundreds of elections from the inside through the programming process. And so it's made a very vulnerable target, and it's made a very, very high reward-to-risk ratio. The reward is tremendous. The manipulations are essentially undetectable under the system that we have now of counting votes and verifying the counts. So you wind up with a huge reward-to-risk ratio that gives every incentive to those who would be bad actors to go ahead and do it.
So when did this start, and how did this happen?
Well, election rigging of the computer age basically came about with the proliferation of computers as vote counting and vote recording instruments. And that was basically the turn of the century. There was punch cards before that. There was lever machines. But it did not become optical scanner and touchscreen machines that are such easy targets until about 2002, when in the aftermath of the 2000 election, the debacle of the hanging chads, that was exploited brilliantly by those who had already had it a plan afoot to computerize American elections. So one kind of has to ask what the hanging chads were all about. There was evidence of sabotage in the 2000 election. That's kind of a side story, but it set it up for the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, which was passed shortly after the 2000 election and has basically used carrot and stick to induce the states across the country very rapidly at that point to computerize their elections and either get these touchscreen machines or optical scanners, which are also computers, they're both computers, to count our votes. And so since the 2002 election, we've been looking at anywhere from 80 to now probably about 97, 98% of our votes being counted electronically in the pitch dark of cyberspace.
So explain a little bit more why and how they are so easy to rig. For example, you have in your book, Code Red, you have the example of how you can start at minus 50 on one side and plus 50 on another. Now, I have to tell you, I am mathematically challenged, although I did get this example. But I'm going to be a stand-in for all those mathematically challenged listeners also. So try to tell us in the simplest terms possible.
Well, computers don't know what zero is. You know, if you're counting ballots by hand and you put one ballot down on the table, you know that the table is zero and the first ballot is one and the second ballot is two. But inside a computer, you can set zero to anything, where the count begins. So in an optical scan computer, for instance, there are anywhere from about 500,000 to 700,000 lines of code on the memory card that controls the count inside that computer. Visualizes the ballots, figures out where the marks are, and begins to add the votes for all the races on the ballot. Interpolating three lines of code into those 500 to 700,000 lines of code, you can alter the zero counter. So, for instance, if you have candidate X and candidate Y, and you set candidate X's zero counters to plus 50, candidate Y's zero counters to minus 50, then the first ballot that comes in for candidate X will be number 51. The first ballot that comes in for candidate Y will be number minus 49 or negative 49. at the end of the day, if there have been 500 ballots cast in actuality for each candidate, candidate X will show 550, candidate Y will show 450. The sum total of those ballots is 1,000. There will be 1,000 voters that signed the poll books. So the election administrator looks at it and says, 1,000 equals 1,000. We have a clean election, and you've just shifted a net of 100 votes. And that's just the simplest of rigs. It's virtually undetectable, even if you had access to that memory card. But the joke is, we don't have access to the memory card. We don't have access to any of the ballots that are stored in that optical scanner. We don't have access to the code that goes into programming those computers. And when I say we, I mean the public, I mean the candidates, I mean the election administrators. The only ones with access are the corporations that do the programming and deployment of these machines and their programming, the hardware and the software. And we've basically turned over the entire vote counting process of the United States to a very small handful of privatized and quite secretive corporations. We know, remember Diebold from the 2004 election. It's now Dominion, ES&S, Hart InterCivic, Sequoia. Again, corporations that are private, they can be pursuing their own private agenda, and from what we've also researched, have very, very strong partisan affiliation. And guess what? It's to the right wing.
Jonathan Simon. His book is Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. Go to writersvoice.net to hear other interviews from our 2016 election coverage. One interview we didn't put on broadcast but did offer on the Writer's Voice website was our hour-long conversation with historian Donna Murch about her article, The Clintons' War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter. Many people say Clinton lost the election because she talked too much about so-called identity politics, i.e. the rights of people of color and the LGBTQ community. But she was challenged by African-American critics like Donna Murch during the campaign for having supported the huge boost in mass incarceration when it happened under her husband's presidency, a bipartisan effort of Democrats and Republicans. We'll air Donna Murch's full interview soon, but here's an excerpt.
One of the criticisms that I got from my article was that the Clintons did not invent mass incarceration. And I would say that is absolutely true. The origins of mass incarceration lie in the mid-1970s, and they have earlier precedents, so there's a strong bipartisan element. But this is what I would say, is that like many state policies, mass incarceration was a process. It didn't just start one day. And if you look at it as a process, the most extreme acceleration in terms of number and punishment actually took place under a Democratic president. So I want to stress that mass incarceration was a process, and also the federalization of the war on gangs and the federalization of particularly the use of conspiracy and a whole kind of setting up these networks for the collaboration between municipal, state, and federal law enforcement under the Clinton era really helps to explain the huge numbers of people that we see in prison. It wasn't new, but it was an acceleration of degree that was quite profound.
In fact, you say that under Bill Clinton, more people were incarcerated than under any other president before him.
That's right. Absolutely. More people were sent to prison at the state and federal level than under any of the notorious Republican drug warriors.
And what was the impact on black communities of this?
Oh, gosh. The impact is just devastating. I mean, I think we have yet to fully even reckon with its impact. There are people that have likened it to genocide, understood in the context of massive loss of family, of whole neighborhoods. Heather Thompson has written about million-dollar blocks where whole portions of blocks have been incarcerated, and that cost of incarceration per year is over $1 million a year. I can tell a short little story about that from my research, which really struck me. When I first started researching my new book on crack and the war on drugs, I was doing interviews in Oakland, which is home of the Black Panther Party. And Oakland has always been for me a very special place because of its real political vibrancy. It's such an important place for all kinds of radical politics, queer, black power, anti-capitalist, a variety of different types of radical politics. And I was interviewing one of the activists from the 1960s, and she told me about an event that happened in 2006 after Ron Dellums became mayor of Oakland. And Ron Dellums called in all of his old lieutenants, all these different political constituencies in Oakland, and they asked each group what they wanted. So you had business people, you had black city council people, you had some of the unions present, but they also invited a group of youth activists who were roughly late junior high, early high school, 14, 15 years old, and they asked them what they wanted. And they said that they wanted grief centers. And the adults in the room were really dumbfounded, and they asked them what they meant. And they said, well, you know, many of us have been raised by our grandparents. Large numbers of our parents have been incarcerated. Some have experienced addiction. And now our grandparents are passing. And we, before we could even begin to talk about what we want, we need a way to mourn. And I thought, I listened to that, I thought about that for years afterwards, that a whole generation of people really were denied their parents. So when we talk about 600,000 people being sent to prison, and that's only including prisons, not jails, which have, you know, an even larger percentage. So I think that it has been devastating at the most intimate level. You know, I think the separation between parent and child is probably the most important experience, part of the human experience. You know, Gil Scott-Heron has this song, "Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul?" And when I think about that, family separation, that to me is most serious. But of course, there are many different aspects of things we can talk about. You know, in many ways, people are being stripped of legal citizenship, stripped of the right to vote, stripped of economic citizenship, stripped of the right to work in the legal economy. Because essentially, to have a felony conviction means that you can no longer work in the legal economy. It's very, very difficult. And of course, the public health crisis of prisons, you know, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, all different kinds of communicable diseases and HIV, the rates for infection are much, much higher. So being sentenced to prison has all these different implications, both of the most personal, but also public health ramifications.
Historian Donna Murch talking with us about mass incarceration. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview, or wait until it's broadcast later in the season. And now for some lighter fare in honor of New Year's. Some years ago, I was fortunate to spend New Year's Day in a tiny village in the backcountry of Provence, where I'd gone to live for the better part of a year. Here's an excerpt from my journal on what the French call the Jour de l'An, or New Year's Day.
January 1st, 2002. After many hours at the keyboard, a stretch turns into the realization that I must take a walk, move, breathe the bright cold air of the day. Outside, it's not as cold as I'd thought. The air has that limpid purity that I love so well here, and the sun takes the edge off the chill. Walking up the long path through the village, I pass Madame Pascal's grocery, closed but not shuttered. I have the feeling that if I knock on the door, she would come, slowly as always, ducking through the narrow passage that leads from her home to the interior of the store, with a little dip to her walk, thrusting her hands deep into the pockets of her blue cardigan, and say, "Bonjour, madame." And as today is New Year, she would add, "Bonne année." Past the tiny café that's only open on Saturdays, and then only for a few hours, past the ancient church with a single, small stained glass window set into its side like a jewel, I come to the village square with its broken public phone and its World War I monument. Such markers can be found in nearly every village in France. Three sides of the ugly obelisk are blank under their battle site headings, Somme, Marne, and L'Isère. But the fourth, Verdun, has 13 names on it, far too many for such a humble community. To my right, some children play a pickup game of soccer. To my left, a group of older men play a game of pétanque. I'm reminded of the games just like it I've seen played on the Houston Street median strip in New York's Little Italy. All the men look alike, short, stocky, bundled up against the cold with caps pulled low on their foreheads, a genotype stemming from the ancient Ligurians who first settled this land. I watch as one man lobs the ball fairly near the goal. Then he lobs another, which falls short of the first. Putain, I hear him mutter as I turn away. I continue up through the otherwise empty village, through the quiet peace of a crisp New Year's Day. Passing out of the village now, I mount the stony path leading to a high lavender field, past the meadows that were thick with mushroom hunters just 2 months ago, but are now deserted, save for the occasional flock of sheep. I listen for the plaintive sound of their bells, so familiar to my walks. But today all is silence. Only the hills call me with their siren song. The thought comes, I love it here because the landscape possesses a peace and clarity that I often find lacking in myself. Pacing one edge of the field, I glance upward to the spot across the valley that my friend Fabienne pointed out to me the first time I visited her. Her lover Olivier died there 4 years ago. Rumors circulate that he committed suicide, but she fiercely denies them. Stories come quick here. Intimate revelations are made so easily to me, a stranger. But there are always layers that remain hidden, pieces missing. A friend recently filled in more of the tale, that Fabienne's lover was married, and he and his wife lived in the same little village. The affair sowed a bitter harvest of side-taking that shook the community. There were those who condemned the liaison for breaking up Olivier's family, others who defended the primacy of love. But there was yet another twist to the story. Fabienne's lover had been a visionary, a pioneer of sustainable forestry, a regional mover and shaker. Some people he moved, others he shook. Some, those who exploited the land the easy way, clear-cutting stands of forest, saw her lover as an adversary. Their handiwork is visible everywhere, leaving great slashes pockmarked with forlorn stumps of trees in the body of the hills. Where they exploited the earth, he stewarded it, and they hated him for it. I think back to an earlier walk. Fabienne had suggested I visit the old stone sheepfold that Olivier had restored. It became a haven for hikers and sheep alike, nestled in the midst of the old-growth forest he owned and husbanded. I trudged for what seemed like hours up the mountain road. It was pitched at an ungodly steep angle. At first, I passed right by the sheepfold, so hidden was it by the sheltering trees. I came to another one at the top of the mountain, this one quite ruined. Its roof of mortarless stones was all fallen in, save for several lithic ribs that still arched from wall to wall. Far below and wide stretched the entire panorama of Haute-Provence, all the way to the Luberon Mountain and over to Forcalquier and the Pre-Alps rising above the Durance River. Cutting down from the Alps toward the ocean, the river was a broad channel of light gray gravel bisected by a turquoise stream of water. The Alps drew a crisp, jagged edge across the horizon, and far to the south I imagined I could even glimpse the faint twinkle of the sea. From my perch, I could also see the broad clear cuts that scarred the nearby hillsides. The trees will suddenly become much bigger, Fabienne had told me, so I would recognize the beginning of Olivier's realm. On the way back down the mountain road, I spied a vestigial path, lightly treading the edge between an overgrown field and a wood filled with birches of enormous girth. Their smooth trunks rose from roots that writhed like nests of gigantic snakes. I felt I was gazing into Pan's country, as the native writer Jean Giono called it. On a hunch, I turned onto the weedy trail. Just beyond the far border of the field, a ghostly shape reared to view in the arboreal gloom, its flat white stones fairly glowing in the afternoon sun. The dark open mouth of its long tunnel gaped as if in surprise at my sudden appearance. I had found Olivier's sheepfold. Inside, a thick layer of wind-blown leaves flooded the floor. Branches and twigs broke the surface. Dampness exhaled a musty breath from the walls. In the adjacent hut, a broken window and latchless door afforded entrance to animals, the weather, and passing humans. These had left behind the evidence of their tenure. Piles of nutshells, droppings, rusty cans, empty wine bottles, scraps of clothing, a cheap sleeping bag dulled by filth. The sad air of neglect that clung to every surface deflated my plans to spend the night. Olivier's spirit had long ago decamped from this space. One night, after having too much to drink, Olivier took his tractor out on the gravel road that curves up and around the mountain overlooking his village. He stopped the hulking vehicle where a turnaround juts precariously over the friable hillside. Whether he came too close to the edge by accident or on purpose is unknowable and perhaps unimportant. The tractor tumbled from the precipice, spilling him out, and he died under its treads. At first, the local police suspected murder, motivated by the personal and political controversies that surrounded him. Maybe it was a local forester who resented the changes that Olivier was trying to bring about. Maybe it was a vengeful relative of his wife's. Those theories were soon ruled out, to be succeeded by rumors of suicide. His enemies longed to discover a lesson of comeuppance in his death. Others sought to find comfort in the purposeful nature of the act, no matter how anguished. That tragedy can happen for no good reason at all is something people are reluctant to acknowledge. But the truth of Olivier's death will never be known for sure. These thoughts rattling around in my head, I turn around and start back home. As I pass once more through the village square, I notice that the pétanque players have reversed the direction of their play. Another round. A player lobs one of the heavy iron balls, then mutters, "Mad." The sun is low on the horizon now, although I'm gladdened to remember that the days have begun to lengthen. Hues grow deeper, more golden, shadows more sharply defined. The tree's silhouettes are black against the still blue sky as I open the door to the kitchen and enter its cave-like darkness. Music you heard was from the album Gymnopédie from the virtual consort with Peter Blanchett. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.